We're studying in the 57th chapter of Isaiah, and we are just finishing the first verse. What we fail to understand many times, then, is that God has a design and a plan, and we do not see the ultimate end of it. What appeared on the surface to be a vicious injustice of Manasseh putting the righteous people to death and filling Jerusalem with their blood actually resulted in the fact that they were taken away from the evil to come. They did not have to participate in the evil that was to come upon this land as a result of this wicked man's deeds. And he says in verse 2, "He shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness." That is, these people actually entered into peace, either the peace of the grave or the peace of another life after this life. Probably he's talking about the peace of the grave, the peace of being in the state of being separated from this life. "He shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds," and the word here, beds, could mean graves, "each one walking in his uprightness." So we read here about the peaceful rest of the grave. And this occurs to each one who is walking in his uprightness or in the way that God would have him to walk. This is a thing that the people of God have to look forward to. They have to look forward to the fact that they're going to have peace when they die. Peace is not death is not a thing for them to dread or to have a great worry about. For death is going to be a means for them to be relieved of the trials and tribulations and the evil to come that's in this life. It is a means of peace for the man of God or the woman of God. It is a means of rest for God's people rather than a thing to be dreaded or to try to avoid. So we see then how God is working with means that we really cannot fathom or understand. Now in verse 3, we have another section of the chapter, still talking about the same great subject now. But this section begins a series of declarations of the judgment of the nation that God was going to give. And it goes from verse 3 through verse 14. He says, "But draw near hither, ye sons of the sorceress, the seed of the adulterer and the whore." Now he's talking to Judah. He's talking to the people who were following after the reign of Manasseh, those who went along with this, those who were allowing idolatry to take the day and to be the major part of their lives. He says, "Draw ye hither, ye sons of the sorceress." Now, as we go back to 2 Kings 21, verse 6, talking about Manasseh, "And he made his sons pass through the fire, and observed times, and used enchantments, and dealt with familiar spirits and wizards. He wrought much wickedness in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger." This shows how Manasseh followed after these spirits, familiar spirits, the wizards. He used enchantments, and he observed times, and he made his sons to participate in this. So here, when God is beginning to call the judgment upon the nation, he says, "Draw near hither, ye sons of the sorceress," as though he's talking to people who are so involved in sorcery that they are referred to then as having a mother who is a sorceress, and they are the sons of the sorceress. This is a very fitting and apt reference to make to them, and it certainly is a further description of the kind of life they were living and the kind of sins they were involved in. And he further says in verse 3, in addressing them, "the seed of the adulterer and the whore." Now, the adulterer and the whore are figures used to illustrate unfaithfulness to God. Those who would go off into sins that are a result of being strictly unfaithful to any vow that you may have with God, Muchly the same as a husband or a wife who would commit adultery or who would play the part of the whore. And so these people in Judea were the seed of the adulterer and the whore. That is, they were the offspring of those who had gone against God and those who had broken the marriage vow with God. The seed of the adulterer and the whore. Verse 4. Against whom do you sport yourselves? Now this word for sport here means gives the idea of somebody who would pit themselves against or who would make a mockery of God. Against whom do you sport yourselves? Just who are you pitting yourselves against? Who are you mocking here? Who are you making light of? Well, the answer, of course, is God and the ways of God. They had gotten so calloused in their sin until they just made a mockery of the things of God. They sported themselves against godly ways. And we see this today, you know, even when people make jokes and mockery about the things of God and they really speak of it in a very light and flitting way, they're sporting themselves against something. They're mocking something, and it's God they're really mocking against. Another question, verse 4. Against whom make ye a wide mouth and draw out the tongue? These are also phrases used to portray somebody who would make a mockery of God. And other places in the Bible use this same figure. They make a wide mouth. They draw out the tongue. That is, they stick their tongue out or they make some kind of a face using the tongue in an odd way. Are ye not children of transgression? A seed of falsehood. Now, anybody who would do this, sport themselves against God, make a mockery against God, make a wide mouth and stick out the tongue in mocking God, they simply then are classifying themselves as children of transgression. They have gone away and astray from the true path of God. They're the children of transgression. And he says, a seed of falsehood. Now, falsehood, of course, is a lie, a false doctrine, something that is taught to be the truth, but it's not the truth at all. It is a lie, and so they are the seed of this. They're the offspring of it. We see how people can very easily then be following after a philosophy, a practice that has its root in a false doctrine that does not have any truth about it, and so they become the seed of this falsehood. And if falsehood is bad, then the seed of the falsehood also has to be bad. Verse 5, inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree. Now he's naming some of the things that they were guilty of doing in their idolatry. This word inflaming really means to burn or to heat up, and it implies then that they were burning with lust with the idols under every green tree, inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree. The custom of the heathen was to plant groves of trees, and there they would put their idol altars, the idol temples, and the idols. And they would go into these groves to carry out the rituals and the worship to the idols. Well, the people of God, when they came into this land of Canaan, they took up this practice of worshiping in the groves, and then they also put the idols and all of the articles that went along with idol worship in the groves, and this is the reference it's made to under every green tree. In Isaiah 1, verses 29 and 30, he makes a reference to this. For they shall be ashamed of the oaks which ye have desired, and ye shall be confounded for the gardens that ye have chosen. Now these oaks that ye have desired, this is a reference to those groves of trees that they would use to conduct their idolatrous worship in. And the word for oaks here may not truly mean the oak tree, but it may mean a different kind of a tree. But the thought's the same, and it doesn't really matter about that. But what he's saying is that the time is coming whenever I'm going to have to punish you for this idolatry. I'm going to take you into captivity for it, and at that time you will be ashamed of the oaks which you have desired. And until they got to the point that they were actually ashamed of these deeds that they were doing, actually ashamed of their idolatry, ashamed of the way that they had chosen to worship and conduct themselves, until they reached that point, then there was going to be no hope for them, really. And so God had to so punish them that he would bring about a state of shame. You should be ashamed of the oaks which you have desired. You should be confounded for the gardens that you have chosen. Now, the gardens were also places in which they had cultivated plants and flowers for the purpose of using it in their worship and places of worship. Still in Isaiah 1, verse 30, "For ye shall be as an oak whose leaf fadeth, and as a garden that hath no water." So he was going to make them then like an oak that whose leaf faded away, and they lost this greenness, this luster, this wonderful feeling that they got from being in this idolatrous grove. They'd be like an oak whose leaf fadeth, and is a garden that hath no water. So this is a reference to their practice, inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree, their practice of using these groves to carry out their idolatry. Now, still in verse 5 of Isaiah 56, "Slaying the children in the valleys under the cliffs of the rocks." Now, this was a reference to the fact that they were actually offering some of their children as an idolatrous sacrifice. Slaying the children in the valleys under the cliffs of the rocks. And there are scripture that bears evidence of that. Even some that seem to imply that Manasseh did that. And you can see how far people will go then when they get the wrong doctrine, to what extremes they will resort to in worshiping something that's not the truth at all. Verse 6, "Among the smooth stones of the stream is thy portion. They are thy lot." Now, this is a very difficult passage to interpret here, and there's a lot of divisions among the Bible scholars as to what it means. And I'd like to give a couple of the things that seem most reasonable to me. One meaning is that, of course, we know the smooth stones of the stream, that those are the stones that are tossed about in the stream and worn until they become smooth. So what he's saying is that out there in the stream, among those smooth stones, that's where your portion is. That's where you have your lot. And it may mean that you're going to be tossed around with the stream like the stones are, and you'll be worn down by this tossing around by the stream, by the waters of the stream. But another meaning of this, which Mr. Barnes gives, and it seems to be very plausible to me, and that is, as he goes back to the root meaning of this phrase, the smooth stones, it does not really mean necessarily smooth stones, but it means a place of division. And what this could mean then is that the place of the stream where there's a division, that's where your portion is. And a lot of this idolatrous worship was carried on in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And this word for stream doesn't have to be confined only to a stream of water, but it can also mean a valley in which a stream flows. So this could be referring to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, talking about the valley being a place of division or a place separation, and this being the place where they carried out their idolatrous worship. And if that's the case, what he's really saying then is that your portion or your lot is out there in that valley where you've chosen to worship. It's not here in Jerusalem. It's not here at the temple. It's not among the things of God and the things which God has promised to his people. But you've chosen to go another way and to another place. And consequently, that's where your lot is. That's where you're going to have to look to for guidance and for sustenance and for comfort, because you have left the things of God. Now, that could be the meaning that he has here. Now, continuing in verse 6, "Even to them hast thou poured a drink offering. Thou hast offered a meat offering." And he's simply saying that there is where you have chosen to worship. your drink offering and your meat offering. And of course, in the true worship of God, he also had drink offerings and meat offerings. And this word for meat offering does not necessarily mean animal flesh, but it can also mean the produce grown from the ground. God required these kind of offerings too, but the idolatrous gods also, in their worship, this was done. And so he says, there's where you have poured a drink offering and you've offered a meat offering. Rather than offering it up here in the house of God to God, as you should, as I have instructed you to do, you've gone out there and have changed the worship, and you're now doing it in an idolatrous fashion, and that's where your lot is, that's where your portion is. And he concludes that verse by asking the question, should I receive comfort in these? That is, how am I supposed to look upon this? Am I supposed to feel good about it? Am I supposed to feel a sense of comfort and satisfaction by your behavior? Why, the answer would have to be no. I don't have any rest. I don't have any comfort. I don't have any ease. I don't have any satisfaction in the fact that you're worshiping in the manner that you're worshiping in. And if we could just see things from God's viewpoint many times, and we can if we'll study the Bible, then we can see how he views our actions. He may view our actions with very, very much disfavor, receiving no comfort at all in what we're doing, and looking upon us as being idolatrous, unfaithful people who deserve to be punished because we simply are going headstrong in a way that is not the way God intended for us to go. Verse 7, upon a lofty and high mountain thou hast set thy bed, even thither wentest thou up to offer sacrifice. He further shows the blatancy of their idolatrous practice. He said, you've gone up on a lofty and high mountain and set thy bed. There's where you go up to offer your sacrifice. Now, the figure here is of somebody who is committing adultery. And instead of doing it in a secret, closed place where nobody knows about it, they'd put the bed up on a lofty and high mountain for everybody to see what they were doing. They were very proud of their activity, and they were not ashamed of it at all. And so that's one of the figures that he gets here. But he says, there's where you went up to offer sacrifice. And so all the world could know, everybody could know, this is how these people are behaving. They are not doing the things that their God told them to do. They're doing things like another God would have them to do. An idolatrous God, which is not truly a God at all, but which is something that comes from the imagination of the people. Verse 8. Now he gives another view of how they behaved. Behind the doors also, and the posts, hast thou set up thy remembrance. Or that is your images. Not only did they do it out in the open, but they also had in their homes, in their secret places, behind the doors, they had set up their remembrance or their images. And it was a common practice in Israel during this time for each household to have its own little idolatrous god in that household. And they had this, then he says, behind the doors and the post has that set up thy remembrance. These idols or these images were used for remembrance. And we see this practice being very, very commonly done today. People have these little emblems that they wear around their neck. These little things that are to this saint or to that saint or to some kind of a good luck charm or whatever. It's a remembrance for them. And they keep it close to them. They keep it in their secret place. They hide it behind the doors. But it's a remembrance to them. Whenever they want to remember something, instead of remembering God, they remember this thing. It's an idol. And you see what an abomination this is then with God for them to do this. Now, I'd like to read some scripture to show that this is not just a practice the people had gotten into and having had no instruction about it. God had condemned this way back. In Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 through 9, he told them there that they were not to use these other things for their remembrances, but they were to use the words and commands of God for their remembrances. Let me read this. Deuteronomy 6, verse 6, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and thou shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the post of thy house and on thy gates. So they were to write these words of God upon the posts of their house and on the gates. They were to use these things for the remembrances and not these idols. Again, we have in Deuteronomy 17, 2 through 5, if there be found among you within any of thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, man or woman that hath wrought wickedness in the sight of the Lord thy God in transgressing his covenant, and hath gone and served other gods and worshipped them, either the sun or moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it be told thee, and thou hast heard of it, and inquire diligently, and behold it be true, and the thing certain, that such abomination is wrought in Israel, then thou shalt bring forth that man or that woman which have committed that wicked thing unto thy gates, even that man or that woman, and shall stone them with stones till they die. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but at the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death. So God had instructed very strongly that if anybody was guilty of idolatry, that it was a sin worthy of death. Again, we have in Deuteronomy 27, verse 15, cursed be the man that maketh any graven or molten image, an abomination unto the Lord, the work of the hands of the craftsman, and putteth it in a secret place. And all the people shall answer and say, Amen. So here, he, in this verse, he forbids somebody taking one of these images and putting it in a secret place. So the instruction was clear, long before these people had gotten into these idolatrous practices, that God did not want this to happen. God was thoroughly opposed to their idolatrous ways, and he instructed them very plainly that they were to avoid this. Well, he says, behind the doors also and the post I set up thy remembrance. We're back in Isaiah 57, verse 8 now. For thou hast discovered thyself to another than me, and art gone up. Now, this phrase, thou hast discovered thyself to another than me, is simply a reference to them having adulterous intercourse with another God besides the true and living God. It's referred to in the sense or in the phraseology that would imply unfaithfulness in marriage. He goes on and says, thou hast enlarged thy bed and made a covenant with them. Thou lovest their bed where thou sawest it. So it's a phrase implying that they were going to bed with someone other than their true marriage partner. They were flirting with and having a relationship with another God besides the true and living God. And so this is the way God looked upon it. He looked upon it as though they had committed a spiritual adultery. And it refers to the fact that they had delighted in the temples and the altars and the groves of idolatry, and they'd made a place for these things in their own nation and among their own worship. They had welcomed them and used them among themselves. Verse 9, and thou wentest to the king with ointment, and didst increase thy perfumes, and didst send thy messengers far off, and didst debase thyself even unto hell. Now this phrase, verse, refers to the fact that they went to the kings of other nations, and they tried to make alliances with these other kings. And we read about them doing it with Assyria and with Egypt. Tried to make alliances with the other kings, and they turned to them for safety and for security and for comfort rather than to the true and living God. And so he is condemning that here, and he's pointing that practice out. Thou wentest to the king with ointment. That is, they took the precious things in trade, or use them to try to barter and to gain favor with these other kings. And didst increase thy perfumes. That is, they use this as a means to gain the favor of the other kings and to help bring about an alliance. And didst send thy messengers far off. That is, they sent messengers or emissaries to try to conduct negotiations. And didst debase thyself even unto hell. That is, they in seeking alliance with the foreign powers and turning to other sources of security besides God, and not depending upon God for security, they had debased themselves or brought themselves down to hell or down to the very lowest depths of degradation. And This is the very thing that people of all ages have done. They turn away from God. They look to other things for their comfort, and they use their own means and their own devices and their own intelligence rather than allowing and depending upon God to help and to guide them. Verse 10, Thou art wearied in the greatness of thy way, yet saidest thou not, there is no hope. Now, they went to such great lengths, they went to such effort, that they were wearied in the greatness of the way. That is, they were tired, they were fatigued, they were worn out from using their own means and their own devices to bring about security and comfort. But even this did not cause them to say there is no hope. Even this didn't cause them to turn away from their idolatrous ways and their seeking after the favor of the other kings. And that's the way it is, of course, with mankind even today. He pursues after things that are not designed to give him peace and security and happiness. He uses all of his strength and energy and money and resources pursuing these things, and yet he still doesn't say there is no hope. He continues to do this to the very end. But if he would just stop and take a good look at what he's doing and seeing that it brings about no benefit whatsoever in the spiritual area and in the area of security, then he would be made to realize that truly he must turn to God. He goes on in verse 10, Thou hast found the life of thine hand, therefore thou wast not grieved. Now this phrase, the life of thine hand, is a very difficult phrase to interpret, and there have been a lot of different interpretations placed on it. But what it seems to me to mean is, when you're talking about the hand, that's the part of a person that's able to work and to make a living and to produce his works. And so the life of the hand then would be the things that you do that sustain you. You're living by what your hand brings about. You found the life of your hand, or the life of your activities. That's your life. That's all you're getting. It's what you're able to bring about yourself. And therefore thou wast not grieved. That is, you get enough good and enough benefit from that just keeps you going. You're satisfied to get along without the true spiritual benefits of God. And so you're living just a kind of a hand-to-mouth existence. You're only living by what you're able to bring about yourself, and you're omitting and losing all of the great benefits that you could get by turning to God and having Him to help and to be a part of your life. Verse 11, And of whom hast thou been afraid or feared, that thou hast lied, and it's not remembered me, nor laid it to thine heart? He asked the question here, who have you been afraid of? You haven't shown any fear for me. You're not afraid of God. You don't have any respect or any reverence for me. You're not afraid of me because you've lied and you've not remembered me, nor laid it to your heart. You haven't taken it seriously at all. The things that I've taught and the things that I desire, these are not a part of your life or a part of your thoughts even. So you're showing that you don't have any reverence for me. You don't have any respect or any fear for me. And the question then would have to be answered, I'm not afraid of anybody. I don't have any respect for anybody. That is, relating to God. They may have respect for what these idolatrous doctrines would teach, but they're not respecting God, or they wouldn't have lied, and they wouldn't have not remembered Him, nor laid it to their heart. A person who truly has a respect for God and a devotion to God, he's going to have a remembrance of God. He's going to take it seriously. He's going to take it to his heart, and it's going to have some kind of an effect on him. But it was not true with these people. He could ask them the question, who are you afraid of? And it certainly was not God, for they had no fear of God.